This is the Country Hour with Megan Hughes on ABC Radio Queensland.
Good afternoon. Thank you for your company on the Country Hour. The Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins, has defended the government's work on net zero for agriculture. So this comes after the opposition criticised Labor's policy, saying it's responsible for driving up power prices. But the minister says the recent move by the Federal Nationals and Liberals to walk away from net zero targets will actually make it harder for farmers to access key markets and achieve their own goals of lowering greenhouse emissions in the sector. She tells Warwick Long, net zero is what industry wants.
Well, obviously our farmers and a lot of our industry groups also have their own targets, Warwick. So we know how important it actually is for agriculture more broadly. When you've got the National Farmers Federation, you know, organisations like Dairy Australia, Wine Australia, you know, and industry groups trying to reduce their emissions because they understand this is important, not just locally in terms of our environment and what we're trying to do with net zero, but also in terms of international trading partners, given that the large percentage of our produce actually gets exported overseas. So it is really important. And unfortunately, what we've seen from the Liberals and the Nationals is that they are all over the place. I mean, we had a wasted decade last time they were in government. They still don't know what they're subsidising or not subsidising, whether it's coal or what other types of industries. And instead, we're just getting on with the job and we're working with farmers on the ground to help them reduce their emissions. And that's what we're about.
If you lose government, essentially, and a lot of these things are really long term in terms of what you're doing to try and reduce emissions, so where does that leave agriculture?
Well, obviously, it puts, you know, Australia's agriculture at risk because, as I said, 80% of it is exported into international markets, and it's in our international customers and markets that are demanding more lower emissions, high quality produce. And Australia has some of the lowest emissions on the planet already when it comes to agriculture. And we should be incredibly proud of our farmers and what they've achieved. I mean, when you look at the red meat industry, for instance, since 2005, they've reduced their emissions almost 78%. I mean, that is extraordinary. We've got some of the lowest use of fertiliser on the globe. We should be celebrating our farmers and we should be supporting them. They're some of the most productive farmers on the globe with some of the lowest emissions, and that's what our government wants to do. We'll let the other side continue to fight amongst themselves and work out what they're doing, but we're going to just get on with the job and work with farmers on the ground.
What is agriculture's role in the government's push to net zero?
Well, obviously agriculture does play a part, but we're not setting any targets specifically for agriculture. We've got an economy-wide target and we're working right across the economy. But certainly, as I've said, you know, farmers understand that the changing climate is impacting them and their bottom line. I mean, they are trying to reduce their emissions because they know that actually they're improving their productivity on farm.
Agriculture is part of the economy though. So it essentially is part of the targets by proxy, yeah?
That's right. Well, obviously we want to reduce emissions across the entire economy. That's right.
Which leads me to the next question. We've got farmers protesting today, locking gates on workers from transmission companies wanting to build transmission lines on their properties to take power from renewable energy sources to the grid. This is a debate between that and mineral sands mines and so much which is about transitioning the economy to a lower emissions that is involving agricultural land use at the moment. Can anything be done there to better manage that transition? Because at the moment in regional Victoria, it feels particularly angry.
Yeah, and we've had a chat on your program before about those land use tensions and the fact that they have been there for a long time, Warwick. We've also had a chat before that, you know, we do think that the consultation can always be improved and done better. I mean, certainly a lot of farmers are benefiting and have a lot of renewable projects on their land and they're diversifying their income and they're getting the benefit from it. But also lowering emissions more broadly across on farm is actually helping farmers with their own productivity and their own bottom line. I mean, some of the modelling that ABARES in my department have done has shown that, you know, climate change is impacting farm profits, but if we actually reduce our emissions, we can improve productivity and improve returns for farmers. So we needn't lose sight of that, and that's the story that we're telling, and we're in Victoria today talking to farmers on the ground about it.
What do you say to communities that are angry about some of these renewable developments in their areas about that transition that they're involved in?
Well, obviously we appointed the transmission commissioner, the infrastructure commissioner, which is the former CEO of the NFF, to work with local communities and to do better consultation, particularly with the energy companies. As I've said, certainly that consultation can always be improved. What I would say more broadly is the vast majority of Australian farmers and indeed Australians support net zero. I would also say that, you know, it is the cheapest form of energy, new energy. And frankly, everybody, the CSIRO modelling, everybody says it's the cheapest form of new energy, and that's what we need to be investing in.
And your energy commissioner says there needs to be more watertight rules around rehabilitating farmland, particularly as programs become to the end of their life. Is that something you want the government to look at?
Well, we're also working, obviously, with farmers and people on land about improving biodiversity and what role the Australian Carbon Credit Units or ACCUs have in terms of biodiversity as well. So we're also doing that work as well.
Agriculture Minister Julie Collins speaking to Warwick Long. Now, if you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. So the other major story this week is US President Donald Trump backflipping on tariffs. So the 10% tariff on Australian beef exports to the United States has been cancelled. This comes from pressure to lower grocery prices. So the president on Friday signed an executive order exempting hundreds of food products from tariffs. Simon Quilty from Global Agri Trends says Australian sheep meat and goat meat are still going to incur this 10% tariff, but the beef trade is back to zero. He says that's a win for Aussie cattle producers, but it actually won't change beef prices for US consumers.
I think overall those fundamentals of lack of supply with a herd, you know, at a 63-year low just remain in place. And, you know, I think from an Australian point of view, it's helpful in that I think given how tight supply is, that that 10% will be passed back very quickly to Australian livestock producers within the next week or so. Matt, we were always believing prices were going to move higher. This just adds a lot more support to the Australian market. Does it lower prices for the consumer in America? No, it doesn't. I think that continues to move higher as they move into their own rebuild.
How bad is it getting over there for US consumers?
Well, Matt, prices are up, if we look at wholesale prices, by about 22% for the year. And beef definitely sits at this elite premium in the market. I think the latest figures is $7.30 per pound versus pork and chicken, which are half that price at around about $3.15. So there's no doubt, Matt, that the pressure is being felt by the consumer. But extraordinarily, Matt, month in, month out, beef consumption continues to be at these levels. Prices rise and the amount consumed continues to increase.
They just love it.
They just love it. And it's the millennials that we can thank, Matt, because they have learned to cook at home. We've seen, you know, the white tablecloth side of the industry has suffered, never really recovered after COVID. And what we've seen is that the retail sector has truly stepped up and filled that void. And as a result, you know, young people are staying at home and cooking expensive meat at home, which they love.
For our audience, Simon, can you explain this 10% tariff on Aussie beef that has been in place for most of this year until now? What difference, if any, has it made to the trade?
It's made no difference, Matt. In actual fact, within the first 3 days when that was introduced in March, we saw the value of Australian lean beef in America on their domestic market jump by 20 cents a pound. So it was passed forward to the consumer in America immediately. So I guess it just makes sense that the Trump administration now realise that it is the consumer paying for these tariffs. It's not being passed back to the exporter in Australia or anywhere else in the world. And so as a result, I think common sense has prevailed and said we need to remove this if we're going to try and lower that cost to the consumer. Unfortunately, I think it's a drop in the ocean, Matt, and that the consumer in America continues to have to pay higher prices, as we said, because the rebuild is about to begin. So the long and the short of it is the impact in America, I think, will be somewhat small.
So just finally, this tariff news that's coming out, plus some rain starting to fall in some key areas of Australia, what's likely to happen to the cattle price?
Continue to move higher, Matt. So particularly in southern Australia, where we've had such a depletion of the herd. And so my expectation is with these good rains that we'll start to see some extraordinarily good prices going into the new year. And I think it really carries through most of next year as global beef supply continues to tighten. Brazil is expecting to go into their own rebuild. The US, southern Australia for sure. Matt, USDA is forecasting 400,000 tonnes less beef exported globally next year. That's a third of what we produce in Australia. So, Matt, the signs are good.
Simon Quilty from Global Agri Trends speaking to Matt Brann. It's 16 minutes past 12. I'll bring you the latest on Rio Tinto's decision to slash its alumina production in Gladstone up next.
Whether you're clocking in, clocking off, or the alarm clock is going off, join your local ABC team when the sun rises each weekday. Join us for breakfast, weekday mornings, right here on ABC Local Radio.
On your radio, online, and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
Rio Tinto has revealed it's going to slash alumina production at its refinery in Yarwun in central Queensland by 40%. This follows concerns about the future viability of the tailings facility. So this slash will happen from October next year, which would allow it to extend the site's operation until 2035, 4 years longer than it was originally forecast to reach capacity in 2031. So the cut will reduce annual alumina production by about 1.2 million tonnes and impact about 180 jobs. Tim McDougall is the General Manager for Bauxite and Alumina at Rio Tinto. He explains the decision to Jasmine Hines.
Developing and working on technical solutions for how we manage our red mud and our tailings facility is where we're putting our focus, but also for our people and redeploying those 180 roles that will be impacted to our other operations here in Gladstone is also a key focus, and the discussions with our employees are extremely important.
Is it expected that all of those 180 jobs could be absorbed in operations in Gladstone, or would it be sort of company-wide?
As you'd appreciate, this is day one in the process. So we are only at the very early stage, and really understanding the preferences of our employees is our primary focus. From there, we'll be able to assess whether we can deploy or redeploy those employees to our operations here in Gladstone at QAL and also Boyne Smelter. But as required, we're also very open to looking at opportunities more broadly in Queensland and also in Australia.
Would Rio Tinto seek government funding for investment to build perhaps the new tailings facility?
This decision is about the economic viability of the tailings facility. It is not about government policy. And we're very focused on solving that problem ourselves. We're not seeking government support with this decision.
For the Gladstone community, which, as you said, has, you know, supported Rio Tinto's operations for decades, you know, this comes shortly after the Gladstone Power Station. That was signalled that it could retire earlier than expected. How can the community be confident in their future in the town as this is sort of happening?
Like I said, we've been in Gladstone for over five decades, 50 years, and we remain very committed to the Gladstone region. And extending the life of our facility out 10 years gives us time to solve the technical challenges and improve the economic viability of a new tailings facility. So this is a strong demonstration in our commitment to the Gladstone region to really solve this technical and economic challenge that we have at Yarwun.
And as I understand, no impact to customer requirements or other operations like bauxite mines or aluminium smelters as a result of this.
Yes, there's no impact on our broader supply chain as a result of this decision.
And what other options are there for the tailings which might be suitable in the future as that technology advances?
I think we're at the very early stage. While we have been studying this for several years now, making the decision not to build a new dam, which is uneconomic with the existing technology, is where we're at right now. And we are commencing work on focusing on those new technologies. That work is still to happen. And like I said, we've got 10 years to solve that technical challenge that's ahead of us.
Tim McDougall is the General Manager for Bauxite and Alumina at Rio Tinto, speaking to Jasmine Hines. Had some texts come through about my earlier story on net zero and listening to the Federal Agriculture Minister, Julie Collins. Kate from Roma said, how can Julie Collins be so incredibly confident that Australian farmers want net zero? She speaks with such broad strokes. This farmer wants best efficiency, not net zero policies, and that's what it is. Chris from the Tablelands said, working with farmers, yes, everyone is disappointed with Liberals and Nationals' lack of any real backbone in making a true stance on anything, but I also don't know of one farmer who is happy with Labor's mess of everything they've touched. Basically, no one has any faith in major parties anymore. All they've successfully done is collectively screw Australia and our farmers over decades to where it is now. And Carol has messaged in about the price of beef. She said, what does the farmers give us a reason for high beef prices here? Can't blame Trump's tariffs, but kind of. So my understanding is if you're seeing that Australian beef is expensive, it's because of the demand that's happening in the US. So it's a matter of supply and demand.
Gallipoli. When it comes to understanding war, art is our secret weapon.
Rachel Griffiths presents When the War is Over.
If it's too risky to say, sing it.
Starts tonight on ABC TV and ABC iView.
On your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app. This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
So I'll take you to the northwest now because the Rural Fire Service says there are currently no fires burning in the region after bushfires tore through thousands of hectares in recent weeks. Rain fell over much of the state over the weekend, helping ease conditions for crews working to put fires out. Rural Fire Service Area Manager for Northwest Gulf, Paul Dunn, tells Madeline McCosker it's thanks to the collaborative efforts of local crews and landholders.
I am happy to say that we currently have no fires burning in the area and we are still actively monitoring some hotspots, but at this stage fire activity has suppressed significantly over the weekend and is now benign.
Fantastic. That must be a great result for all your crews and the property owners that were being impacted by those fires. I guess, do you put that down to the firefighting efforts on your end or the rain over the weekend? How did you get them all under control?
It's a bit of a combination of both. So we have wonderful landowners out in our area and wonderful brigades as well who work collaboratively together and help suppress those fires. And the rain was just a welcome addition to relieve our fatigued crews and our fatigued property owners in helping them suppress the fire.
Yeah, and I'm also guessing that, you know, that bit of moisture on the ground now will help conditions for the next week or so. How are you feeling about the rest of the bushfire season? You know, we've got a long season ahead of us still. How are you feeling about that?
So whilst the rain was welcome over the weekend, we still sit in a risky period with high fire danger ratings expected until the weekend. So we're asking everybody that listens to just remain vigilant over the heightened bushfire risk period and make sure that if they do spot smoke, that they ring 000 and our brigades will come out and give a hand wherever needed.
And in terms of, I guess, the conditions on a longer term forecast, how are you feeling about the rest of the bushfire season in the coming months?
We're closely monitoring conditions over the next couple of months, and the Rural Fire Service is quite, we're well poised to be able to deal with any current or emerging threats that come out with help with our landowners.
Mm. And a number of the fires that were burning in recent weeks did make their way through quite a lot of country. Do you have any idea how much land was burned in any of these fires?
Not off the top of my head, no. I can say that the fire that happened up in Normanton was roughly around about 77,000 acres, and we did have crews, landowners and water bombing aircraft working on that fire for probably around about a week.
Wow, yeah, okay. So obviously in these situations, a lot of collaboration between local landholders and the fire departments as well. How essential is that collaboration between those two units?
It's absolutely vital that we have collaboration between our property owners and our rural fire brigades and also other agencies such as Queensland Parks. We also work very closely with AgForce just to make sure that our graziers and our landowners are fully aware of their responsibilities and what to do when a fire starts.
Paul, we're talking more about the northwest at the moment, but if you're able to, can we get a bit more of a broader look across the listening area in the central west and the southwest? Do you have any idea of the fire situation in those two areas?
So the rain over the weekend certainly helped with those two areas as well. And I can happily report that at this stage we don't have any current fires burning in those areas. We do have one burning just north of Hughenden, but that's the only one that I'm aware of.
Excellent. Good news to hear after, you know, a long few weeks to try and put these fires out.
It certainly has been an interesting fire season so far this year, and my hat goes off to our property owners and our rural fire brigades that covered 93% of our state, and we wouldn't be able to do this without them.
Rural Fire Service Area Manager for Northwest Gulf, Paul Dunn, speaking with Madeline McCosker. Great news. There are currently no fires in the west thanks to the rain over the weekend. Now, it's not just been raining in Queensland, though. The wet season has started in the Northern Territory. So for cattle stations that have jagged some rain, it's been a great start. But for mango growers who are still trying to harvest fruit, this rain can be actually a bit costly. Han Shengxia grows mangoes out at Lambell's Lagoon, southeast of Darwin. He explains to Matt Brand where they're up to.
Yeah, Matt, we actually have binned the rain. We managed to madly pick 90 bins in the last 3 days with six people, whatever we're left with. We would normally keep the fruit on the trees and slowly pick it over the next 2-3 weeks, but unfortunately the rain and the forecast of a lot of rain in the future, we decided to harvest early and trying to cold store it. Unfortunately, it's just too much rain.
Yeah, right. So you had faith in the forecast and decided to pick everything you could before it arrived.
Correct. Yeah. We the last 5-6 days we were dodging the rain. It looked like it was a good day, and then as soon as we went out, harvested, and within half an hour it rained on us, so we had to stop. And then once it stopped raining, we had to go out and try to dry the trees with the air blaster, just blowing air on it. And then once it's harvested again, it just started raining again. So it's just been trying to, run around the rain. So we made the decision when I had a good day, we just try to harvest as much as we can and try to send as much as we can down to the markets.
Right. Now, so were you still picking a few this morning or too wet?
No, We actually harvested. We finished harvesting our mangoes on Saturday, and we've just been packing them the last 3 days in the shed. So we're now dry inside the packing shed, so which is pretty nice. And we have 90 bins to pack, and we are looking forward to in 2 more hours. I will be done for my season for this 2025.
Rightio, a race against the rain. What are you hearing elsewhere in the region? Would there be some farmers who sadly still have a lot of fruit on the trees?
In the Northern Territory region, we are generally the last farm, top end, to actually be harvesting mangoes. We have a late variety, which is why we've always harvested in late November, and that the forecast always indicated our 1,000 to 2,000 trays a week. But a lot of the other farmers in this region have already finished or just stopped and given up. But as in Catherine, I think they're still harvesting. I haven't really heard much from that down that direction yet. I think the other day I was looking at a middle point. It recorded 34 millimeters just on the Saturday. And I think, I don't know what last night's recording was. It just rained all night long. So I woke up to a nice pitter pat on the roof.
Yeah. And do you mind explaining to our audience why rain can be troublesome for mango growers?
So, yeah, mangoes are grown in the territory. We like to harvest it in September, October, when it's the least amount of rain. It's very susceptible to fungal rot or anthracnose is what we call it. And there's two methods you can go around. You can either harvest it before it starts raining, or we can do fungicide treatments. And the easiest option is to harvest it before it rains and make sure the fruit's dry when we harvest them. They're like fungal spores that fly around with the rain on the trees, and they can attack the fruit. So that's what we're trying to avoid, to have when in high humidity areas.
Well, well done on beating the rain. And I hope the season in general's treated you kindly this year, huh?
Yeah, it's been really well. It's been a long season. We've been going since late August, and yeah, I'll be glad to sit up, put my feet up, and have a decent sleep.
How's the wallet? Have you made a few dollars this season?
Yeah, I might have to get a bigger pants. My wallet's a bit thick right now.
Oh, geez, that's good news.
The pricing is it's been reasonable for us. I've heard a lot of other growers had different mixed stories. So I think with how our season turned out, we've had a good early season with our variety of mangoes, and then once we've finished, a lot of the other mangoes came on board, and then with our later varieties like the ones that we've got now, we're just generally trying to slow the market on the volume of market, so the prices kind of stay at quite a nice niche pricing. So far we're reasonably happy with what we've got.
Yeah, no, beat the rain, made a dollar. Love it. Yep. Thank you so much for being on the Country Hour today, Han. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks, Matt.
Northern Territory mango grower Han Shung Sia speaking to Matt Brann. Weather's up next.
And this cricket on Friday, join ABC Sport for the first Ashes test between Australia and England. Hear every ball of the cricket all summer long.
The Ashes.
On your radio and on the ABC Listen app.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
It's time to check in on the weather, and Phelim Hanafy joins me now from the Bureau of Meteorology. Good afternoon, Phelim.
Good afternoon indeed.
So, is there any risk of showers and storms over the coming days?
Yeah, indeed. So the focus of the shower and storm activity today very much up over the peninsula, where we still got the ongoing risk of some heavy falls as well, particularly as we go into the rest of this afternoon and evening. And it's driven by a trough that's lingering up there at the moment. In fact, that trough connects, you know, to a developing tropical low or a developing tropical cyclone potentially off the Northern Territories at the moment as well. And that system continued to wind itself up. It's as that system becomes better organised, that'll eventually pull that trough away from the peninsula. So we'll see that shower and storm activity, which has been persistent up there for the last few days, easing and as that system shifts northwards. So we're pretty later in the week, but certainly for the rest of today and tomorrow, the risk of heavy falls, particularly on the northern half of the peninsula, really, over the next few days.
Hmm. And what does that mean for coastal waters?
Yeah, indeed. So coastal waters have been generally benign winds overall. We've seen a southeasterly push up along around the southeast coast now, a little bit more moderate and strange, not significantly strong. But that southeasterly will eventually make its way up along the tropical east coast as we see a ridge strengthening along the coast. That will eventually also help to push that trough northward and north of the peninsula later in the week as well. It should bring somewhat of a slight cooler reprieve for parts of the tropical east coast, which have been very, very hot. In fact, Townsville at the moment, 36 already, hitting 36 today. So very, very hot conditions along parts of the tropical northeast coast, but cooling off a little as that southeasterly freshens up here. But no strong wind warnings expected, but certainly by the latter part of the week, maybe a little bit fresher southeasterly in play along that northeast tropical coast.
And what about in Western Queensland?
Now, in Western Queensland, it's pretty cool. In fact, it's mostly fresh across much of interior and Western Queensland today as well, apart from the tropical east coast, where we've still got that heat holding on. But, mostly fresh. In fact, overnight mins into the low double digits, so are in low teens, so no speed fresher. Daytime maxes will warm up significantly, though, as we go to the latter part of the week, particularly Friday and into the weekend, getting into the 40s, even the mid-40s in parts, particularly the southwest over the weekend and into the early part of next week. That's ahead of a trough system that's going to approach from central Australia. Later in the weekend, we get the northerlies picking up, and that really drives the heat. And with the heat come the elevated fire dangers, but also the risk of some heatwave conditions developing in parts of the southwest over the weekend as well. In fact, overnight mins are not dropping below the high 20s, and that's following on from daytime maxes into the mid 40s as well over the weekend. So severe heatwave conditions, certainly a watch point in parts of the far west, and particularly the southwest late this week and particularly over the weekend.
And I guess what is driving all of this?
Yeah, indeed. So it's driven by a combination. We've got a ridge building up along the east coast. And we've got that trough in the far north as well. And we've got another trough form up through the interior as well. So though much of interior Queensland is pretty benign at the moment, little or nothing really in the way of showers or storms, we'll see a bit more showers and storms develop across parts of central and southern Queensland as we go to the latter part of this week. And that'll be driven by an inland trough as well. So some of that activity could get into parts of the far southwest of the state, but not likely to get into the far west, so we'll see the heat building there, but certainly across inland parts of central and southern and southeast Queensland, we'll see more of the way of shower and storms developing through the latter part of this week. Couldn't rule out some isolated severe activity as well, particularly in parts of the southern interior and maybe the southeastern interior as well, as we go to late this week as well. And then probably as we head into early next week, we'll see a more significant trough from central Australia move into western Queensland. So maybe that'll bring a bit more broad scale increased shower and storm activity across much of the state as we head into early next week. So perhaps next week looking a bit more stormy broad scale, but the activity to the latter part this week will be a lot less extensive than what we've seen in comparison to earlier this week or late last week as well, but still perhaps a severe thunderstorm risk for some parts of inland southern and southeastern interior Queensland.
So what sort of totals are you expecting?
Now, this activity a lot less isolated. In fact, the most meaningful shower activity really over the next few days is very much up over the Northern Peninsula, where we could still see some localised falls of 50 to 100 mil with showers and storms. And even the activity later this week in parts of central and southern Queensland likely to be a lot more isolated in comparison to what we saw over the weekend and late last week as well. Couldn't rule out some isolated falls of 30 or 40 mil, maybe around the far south there on the southern Darling Downs and northern New South Wales, that kind of border area there. But most other areas, a lot less than that. And the activity, a lot more isolated in nature. Probably the next main watch point in where we see a bit more extensive shower and storm activity will come through the early days of next week.
And just quickly, the tropical low sort of in the top end, what's the latest on that?
Yeah, indeed, it seemed to have a good blow up actually overnight, and it's looking pretty spirally. If anyone has a chance to look at the satellite, in fact, the system really getting its act together and pretty organised. It has a high chance of developing into a tropical cyclone from around the middle of this week, maybe late tomorrow. But in fact, it is getting its act together very quick, and in fact, it looks pretty organised already. If anything, it even looks like it's trying to form a little eye as well. So that may mean that system getting sacked quicker as well. And you could see a named system, in the coming 24 to 36 hours. A lot of the models show it moving south and eventually towards parts of the Northern Territory coast as well to the latter part of this week. So we could see a landfalling tropical cyclone. And if it does get named as well, Fina is the next name on the list. So we could see a named system there as we go through the latter part of this week. And a lot of the models show it making landfall on the Northern Territory's coast near Darwin, Category 2, even possibly a Category 3 system on some of the models at this stage. So, yeah, certainly it is the tropical cyclone season, but certainly is early in the season for such a system.
Phelim, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure as always.
Phelim Hanafy, Senior Forecaster at the Bureau of Meteorology.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio Queensland.
had some texts come through during the weather on earlier stories. Carol said, demand, that's the excuse. It just means that the domestic market continually gets ripped off, whether it's beef or anything else. And we were talking earlier about what's driving up beef prices in Australia if, you know, we don't have the Trump tariffs on our own beef. And I think that's just the reality of the Australian agricultural industry. So much is exported. So much of what is produced is exported, which means we're very, very volatile to international prices and international demand. Paul has also said some US fast food restaurants that use Australian beef in and out. Carl's Jr. has a premium burger that is Australian beef, but he's not sure McDonald's if it uses beef from Australia or New Zealand. If you want to join the conversation on the Country Hour today, you can send me a text on 0487 993 222. Well, I'll take you to the Gulf because the tiger prawn season hasn't delivered the haul a lot we're hoping for, with some fishers reporting catches down by as much as 30% compared to last year. Austral Fisheries says the cold weather and slow trawling conditions were so tough, their northern prawn fleet came back to shore early before the official end of the season. And it means you and I might feel it at the checkout this summer with pricier prawns and less supply. Austral Fisheries Northern Prawn Fleet Operations Manager Brian Van Wicks tells Abby Holter.
Technically, there's still a few nights of the fishing season left. We have all our fleet back in Cairns now. It's been a really tough season. We've dealt with some pretty tough weather. We had very cold water temperatures, probably 2 to 3 degrees below average for August, which really slowed fishing down. And every time it looked like it was about to heat up, we had a blow from the south that would push the water temperatures back down. In terms of catch, it was very slow season, probably 20 to 30% lower than last year.
What kind of an impact will that have on the industry for this season?
It's going to have a relatively big impact. It's been a tough 4 years, so the industry has been struggling over time. We're seeing costs rise. Prawn prices haven't really matched that. Struggling to retain good crews. And after a season like this, or a year like this, it certainly makes it tough for operators. So at the moment, we're very much just in survival mode, cutting back costs, doing everything the best we can, and hoping that Mother Nature can turn things around and the prawn market will follow.
Does it concern you for the next couple of years?
Yes and no. It does concern me. It's a hard thing to grasp when you spend so much effort as industry on sustainability and getting the right people and doing everything right. The environment is good. Prawns have a dynamic nature. You have good seasons and bad seasons. But the thing that's really, really pushing this industry down is a market that won't follow. So the competition between worldwide aquaculture, the fact that in Australia almost 70% of the seafood consumed is imported, we're just not seeing the prices that we need to be able to keep an industry like this going long term.
With catches being down, as you said, 20 to 30% this season, what will the market look like heading into the holiday and Christmas busy period?
Yeah, there'll certainly be an increase in price, but not anywhere near to match those sort of catch rates. Potentially 10 to 15% increase as a guess leading up to Christmas. I imagine that would carry through to consumers as well at the other end from the retail perspective. But the messaging is pretty strong. We really want consumers to pick Australian leading up to Christmas for quality, sustainability, and to help keep this industry alive, because without us, it's really comes down to two options, a farm prawn or an imported prawn.
The issue of Australians not having as many Australian options for seafood, and as you said, 70% of the country consume international or imported seafood, is it just getting, I guess, tougher and tougher every year to sort of face that fact?
It is. It certainly is. It is hard. Like, cost of living, it's difficult for everyday Australians to be able to afford seafood, and seafood is at times a luxury item, only really there for Christmas periods or special occasions. So I totally get it. and consumers' preference is shifting to convenience, so things that are ready to eat, and price certainly comes into that on a shopping list. But it comes down to education and trying to get people to understand where their seafood comes from and the impacts that come with it from overseas as well.
With another tough season sort of in the bag, what are you hearing from fishermen on the ground talking about, you know, this is their livelihoods as well? Are a lot more of them deciding to pack it up?
Yeah, there's certainly a few that are packing up, trying to sell. There's also the crews out there that have built careers and livelihoods around it. A lot of them understand the difficulties. They're living in it as well. And we're focusing on things we can control, like packing better quality and branding, reducing environmental impact. They're totally on board. It's just very difficult for them when they're getting reduced pays year after year compared to land-based jobs. It's very hard to keep people satisfied.
And for whatever prawns are around for people this Christmas, what's the quality they're looking at?
There'll be a mixture. It depends on what they're doing with them. For those that are presenting the whole prawn on a table and kind of like the centerpiece or the highlights, they're looking for larger prawns, vibrant colours, stuff that really impresses the guests. For those that are potentially peeling or barbecuing, crumbing, then certainly looking for bang for buck. So that's where things like banana prawns are really good options from the supermarkets, because they're quite affordable and they're very tasty and good quality. So yeah, it really comes down to what people are planning for the Christmas table.
Austral Fisheries Northern Prawn Fleet Operations Manager Brian Van Wyk speaking to Abby Holter. It is 14 minutes to one, and before 1 o'clock, I'll introduce you to some pretty amazing rural women.
New from ABC Books.
The Muster Dogs are ready to round up your heart with a brand new photo book, Muster Dogs The Next Generation. Find it, plus Muster Dogs calendars, plush toys and more at abcshop.com.au.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
Issues that some women outside of capital cities face are going to be front and centre in state parliament this week. A delegation led by Queensland Rural, Regional and Remote Women's Network is going to be appealing to ministers for greater support and investment. Bundaberg's Kate Giles is among those making the trip down to Brisbane.
The key priority areas that we've found information from our cohort of members are facing around mental health and wellbeing, the issues around the energy transition and the support regional communities really are looking for, also around women's financial literacy and economic participation.
What sort of feedback have you gathered from women in rural and regional areas to inform what you will be saying to MPs this week?
Well, we have some real data that the board of the Queensland Regional Rural and Remote Women's Network have collated over a number of years that have resulted in our annual report for 2025. And that's where we've really been able to drill down on what those real issues and worries and challenges are for women within Queensland.
Why would these challenges be more evident in women outside of metro areas?
Well, one of those priorities that I hadn't mentioned earlier was around telecommunications and digital infrastructure. The real issue is being connected holds so much value, to be able to connect to our communities, but also be able to do business, have learning opportunities, and really be able to lead and have communities that thrive. So that's one real issue. And the backbone of everything that regional women need the support with is that mental health. Without thriving women, our community's backbone somewhat diminishes, and that's a real negative situation for our communities, particularly in rural and remote areas, to have to deal with in isolation.
Speaking of isolation, we often hear about people who are working the land often deal with mental health challenges and face those barriers. Is that what your data indicates as well?
I think there's certainly unique challenges for those that live and work on the land. Those particularly that don't have a support network within an easy geographic distance. the ability to be able to access services is diminished as well, sometimes as a result of those poor telecommunications and digital connectivity. But yeah, there are certainly some specific challenges for those on the land, but it's also those within those smaller communities that also struggle with these same issues as well.
What are you hoping the MPs take away from the message the delegation is sending this week?
I'd love to show the MPs and ministers that regional women are stepping up. We're leading our businesses, we're driving local economies, we're supporting our communities, and generally love to hold everything together through difficult times. But we can't continue to absorb those pressures without better support, more investment within mental health services, our local infrastructure. And regional capacity building isn't an optional. It's fundamental to our long-term community wellbeing and real regional economic success.
Kate Giles is part of the Queensland Rural Regional and Remote Women's Network delegation to State Parliament.
The ABC Listen app lets you take ABC Radio with you wherever you go. At home, in the gym, up a ladder, on the road,
interstate,
out of space. Download the ABC Listen app today.
You're listening to the Queensland Country Hour on your radio, online and on the ABC Listen app.
I'll take you to market shortly, but first, it was at 15 years of age that Tasmanian Ashley Macoris Mitchell fell in love with shearing. And 6 years later, she'd break records in the famous shearing sheds at Cooinbill Station in New South Wales. Here's Helen Shield with more.
With the familiar smell of lanolin in the air, the buzz of electric clippers all around her and a lamb in her grip, 21-year-old Ashley Orest Mitchell was working hard in the iconic shearing shed at Cooinbill Station, and a record was in reach.
When we got about halfway through and, like, 21 shearers, and one of them said, you know, like, you're leading the board, and I hadn't really taken much notice, and then I got to the second last day and they said, you know, Ash, if you really want it, the title of ringing the largest operational shearing shed left in Australia, like, you can do it. You've got one that you just need to push for another day and that's it, you've got that title.
Six years before, upon first stepping into a wool shed, Ashley knew it was where she wanted to be.
Just the noise and the smell, and it was a smell that now, like, every time I walk into a shed, I don't even smell it. But at the time, just the sheep and everything, and people go, oh, sheep smell. I'm like, well, I'm used to it now, like six years full-time in the sheds. You get used to it, and it's a smell that you love. And once, you know, if I have a bit of time off, all I want to do is get back into the sheds and smell that smell again.
As someone who didn't grow up on a farm, her introduction to shearing had been unorthodox.
So one of my teachers at school, she was an art teacher and had a few sheep, and Mum and her were friends, and one day we were there and she said, oh, Ash, you know, we're shearing tomorrow if you want to come and, you know, see what the shearing shed's all about. So off I went, and I was 12 at the time, and the shearer said to me, oh, in the school holidays I've got 2 weeks wool handling if you want to, you know, see what a real shearing shed's about. And off I went at 12 years old, and I was set. That's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be in the sheds, and nothing could ever get me out of them after that point. Just everything I did was focused on someday working full-time in the shearing sheds.
At 15, she started wool handling, doing her schooling remotely, first passing year 10 and then finishing year 12 while working full-time.
It was a lot. Like, I'd work, you know, 8 hours, travel an hour back home, get home at 6, 6.30 at night, have tea, and I'd go and sit down and do 2, 3 hours of schoolwork every night. But I'm so glad now that I finished year 12 and I still got to do what I wanted to do every day.
In shearing, physical strength is highly valued. It is tough.
Even lambs, they don't want to sit still. It's like taking a young kid to a hairdresser. They don't want to sit still in a chair every time you put the scissors near them. They go, oh, what's going on here? And a lamb does the exact same thing. They're trying to jump around and they don't know what's going on.
But while not the strongest physically, Ashley was strong in other ways.
You know, the sheep are kicking or your gear's not quite going quite right. But if your mind goes, and if you start to think, oh, you know, this day's not it, then that's it. The sheep know they'll kick. So it's all mental. And, like, you know, I'm smaller and not as strong as some of the guys, so I can't, you know, muffle the sheep. I've got to think about other ways of getting that sheep to be comfortable and to sit so I can shear it.
A ringer in shearing is the fastest shearer in the shed, kind of an honorary title that shearers compete for. It commands respect because it's hard to do. Come 2025, and shearing brought Ashley to the massive Coonabill Station in New South Wales, a legendary place in Australian shearing. On her game, by the second last day, she'd break the female record at the station for the most Merino lambs shorn in a day at 400. But it was on the last day, encouraged by her fellow shearers, she'd get the title she could forever be proud of.
If you keep going, you can ring the board. And, like, I was done. I thought, no, I'm just going to cruise along tomorrow. And they went, come on, like, you've got to get that title as well. And I think that pushed me along.
Sore and stuffed, she put her head down and did it.
So out of 21 shearers, two females on the board, me being one of them, yeah, I'd shore the most sheep over 10 days out of all of them. I'm the first woman ever to ring Coonabill Station.
So where to now for this young gun shearer?
I'm not really sure. Everyone keeps saying, oh, you should go for a record and do this, and if you start training, like, you've got what it takes. So I don't know. I think, like, next 12 months I'll just keep shearing like I am, and then after that I'll make a decision as to if I want to keep shearing or, yeah, go for a record or just go and do something else.
That was Tasmanian Ashley McCorrist-Mitchell, who is a young gun shearer, and Helen Shield put together that story. What an incredible woman. Just amazing some of the work that she's done, and from such a young age too. Markets are up next. That's Cross to the Roma store sale with David Friend.
Income report. Some wonderful rain around the Mount Isa region, which reduced cattle numbers at Roma to 3,655 head. All the regular buyers are 10 and active, a quality yarding pen with Western bred bullocks and feeders. The market considerably stronger from prime bullocks and feeders, as well as cattle suitable to restockers. At the time of this interim report, yearling steers 200 to 80 kilos realised 600 cents to restockers. Yearling steers 280 to 330 kilos, topping at 598 cents to average 542 cents a kilo to restockers. Yearling steers over 330 to 400 kilos sold to 568 cents to restockers. Yearling steers 400 to 480 kilos made to 540 cents a kilo to lot feeders. Yearling steers over 480 kilos to 514 to lot feeders. Grahama steers 500 to 600 kilos to 480 cents a kilo also to lot feeders. Bullocks over 600 kilos to 498 to processors. And bulls over 600 kilos to 412 also to processors. This has been David Friend, the National Livestock Reporting Service at Roma.
And Errol Luck is watching the prices at the Warwick sale yards today.
Good afternoon. Warwick agents spent 1,605 good quality and well-finished cattle, a small increase of 106 head. The buying panel included the regular and southern processes, which resulted in bullocks and cows lifting from 11 to 27 cents a kilo. Feeder buyers also lifted prices on steers and heifers from 8 to 26 cents. The time is written report, yearling steers in the 280 range to restockers are made to 550. Yearling steers over 280 to restockers sold to 530. Yearling steers to feed the domestic market made to 520 to average 491. Heavy yearling steers to feed sold to 517 and averaged from 476 to 503. Medium weight yearling heifers to feed sold to 460, averaged 422. Heavy yearling heifers to the wholesale meat trade sold to 469 and averaged from 441 to 467. Bullocks to processors sold to 485 and averaged from 469 to 472. Lightweight plain condition cows to processors made 359 to average 344. Heavy score 3 cows to processors made 390 with the best heavy cows topping at 437 to average 413. This has been Errol Luck from LA's National Livestock Reporting Service.
That's all we have time for on the Country Hour today. Thank you so much for your company. It's always a pleasure, especially getting as many text messages as I did today. I really love that. I always love to hear from you. Now, tomorrow's show, you'll hear from Sophie Johnson instead of me, but I will be back on your airwaves and in your ear from Thursday. It's coming up to 1 o'clock. News time now.